Right, so my name is Kevin Dunbar. I'm the director of the English Chlamydia Screening Program, and rather than just talk about chlamydia, I'm going to talk about a range of things we've done, but really I'm going to go over the kind of story of the experience of this work that we've had in England for the last decade or so. I'm going to talk about three main points: the rolling out of the Chlamydia Screening Program, which is a population-wide STD control program, how we've used our data to inform and monitor our HIV testing policy, and about how we targeted resources using that data, and how we've used waiting times as an easy-to-measure service quality metric to drive improvement and to expand our services. So just to give you a little bit of background context, for those of you who don't know, England has a national health service. It's a socialized medicine. It's free at the point of delivery. It's entirely funded by taxes. And services up until 2013 were paid for through local commissioning groups called primary care trusts. So the federal government would provide primary care trusts with money, and then they would be expected to buy services for the local population. Overseeing these primary care trusts were strategic health authorities who ensured that the PCTs were hitting the targets and achieving the required expectations that national government had set up for them. This all changed in April 2013, but I'm not going to go into that in any great detail until the very end. And anybody here who's British will know why. Attendances at STD clinics, so this is the starting point. This is from 2001. We had a real problem in England. Attendances at STD clinics had doubled over the previous decade. We had HIV diagnoses per year that were at historical highs, and this, from a survey, one in four teenagers thought that the oral contraceptive pill was protecting them against infection. It is unsurprising then to learn that we had the highest teenage pregnancy rate in Western Europe, given this level of knowledge. So this highest burden of poor sexual and reproductive health was borne by the poor, women, men who have sex with men, and ethnic minorities. So in response, our government's Department of Health set out the first ever national sexual health and HIV strategy. And that was in 2001, and it aimed to improve services and improve the support for populations, to reduce these inequalities that we had seen, and to improve health and well-being, ultimately by fostering a culture of positive sexual health. Specifically, we set out to ensure that there was sufficient access, open access to STD clinics and contraceptive services. We needed to expand capacity by ensuring that primary care services were taking up the straightforward sexual and reproductive health care services that were appropriate in that setting, and we needed to reduce our new HIV diagnoses. We needed to shorten waiting times for STD clinics because the services were being overwhelmed. So there were some challenges here in our surveillance and monitoring systems. We then required to enhance our existing surveillance, which was needed for our STIs. We needed to enhance our surveillance services so that we could monitor service delivery by region, by risk group, and over time. And we needed to be able to monitor service quality so that we could drive service quality improvement. So if I talk about chlamydia screening first, because I know a little bit about it, our aim of the program was to reduce the prevalence of chlamydia and obviously the sequelae that come from the infection. Services were delivered primarily in community care and in primary care services. And testing was monitored to estimate coverage. So just to unpack this a little bit, coverage is the number of tests divided by the total people in our age range in that area. And that data was then fed back to local areas so they'd get some feedback and some knowledge on what was happening in their patch. So that was 2003. And this is a graph of the estimated coverage. That's the number of tests over the total population. The planned rollout started from 2003 to 2007. As you can see, there wasn't a great deal of rollout. And actually, if you look at the coverage figures, the combined coverage figure for 2007 was 4.9%, which was not sufficient or adequate. So the Department of Health decided to respond to this problem by setting a target and adding some financial incentives to the primary care trusts who were meant to achieve those targets. The initial target was 15%, mm-hmm. and there was some money attached to this. And obviously, as you can see from 2008's data, this was very successful. Mm-hmm. And we know when an idea is good and it works, we'll do it again. So by 2008, we had 15.9% coverage, and the Department of Health then set a further target of 17% coverage to expand capacity even more. This again successfully achieved an increase in coverage and testing capacity across England. And this continued, we go the right direction, this continued up to the peak of 25% in 2010-11 financial year, and a peak coverage of 28.5%. So obviously, very effective at getting out that testing and capacity, the building that we needed to do over that period of time. Unfortunately, it wasn't completely clear sailing. In 2007, we had 100% of the PCTs signed up to doing chlamydia screening, but the service coverage varied from area to area. So some areas had as little as 4% of people being tested, and other areas were doing very well, having 36% of people being tested. or 36% of tests over the population. So by 2011, however, screening had achieved really quite high levels of coverage. And this has been evidenced by our recent NATSAL survey, which I encourage everybody to go and read, where chlamydia testing in sexually active young people between 16 and 24 was reported to be 54.2% women and 34.6% in men. So we feel we've got a very good level of coverage in our population at this point. However, with coverage targets came some perverse incentives. Primary care trusts were prioritizing accessibility over need. We had widespread use of outreach in universities, schools, and sporting events where we knew we could access young people. But unfortunately, these were populations with known low prevalence. Programs used gifts and incentives to encourage testing, and so you can imagine if you get a chance to win a Nintendo Wii and a bit of encouragement, and you have a few big gulps, you can make a good stab at winning that Wii with a few samples per day, and I think the record was somewhere around 40. So this resulted in slightly lower positivity rates than we were really aiming for, and this limited our ability to materially impact on prevalence infections, which was not our aim. So we've changed our target, and we now use a diagnosis rate indicator. So this diagnosis rate indicator is essentially the number of positive tests over our population age group, and we feed this back locally to the commissioning bodies. And the reason we've used this is it's a combination of testing activity and prevalence. So if you have a service which provides a high positivity rate, they'll contribute to your diagnostic rate much more effectively than a service that's low. So it encourages investment in good services like community contraceptive services or STD clinics, which have a much higher positivity rate than in, say, outreach in university and freshers' weeks. So the PCTs were told to achieve a 2,400 per 100,000 figure in people between 18 and 24, but the financial incentives were removed, because by this point, the actual infrastructure for the service was really in place, and it was taken away and assumed that this would continue to drive a maintenance, if not an improvement of the program. But on top of this, the reason that the target has recently changed was we had a material change in our political rhetoric. The word target no longer exists in our health department. So we no longer have the ability to set targets and expect people to achieve them. But if you want some very interesting information about this, I'm going to plug one of my friends. There's a very interesting talk by Gwenda Hughes at Symposium 5E on Thursday, which will unpack the data around what we use to monitor and evaluate the chlamydia screening program looking at coverage. So our new diagnostic rate indicator, this is just data, just to explain this slide. This is a graph of quarterly data of our coverage, so the number of tests over the population, and positivity, so the number of positive tests over the population. And what we've seen is, if you're an optimist, you may be convinced to believe that this is a line showing an increase in positivity, or a stable level of positivity, and you might be convinced to think that coverage is falling a little bit, but with a stable or increasing positivity. So if you're optimistic about this, then it shows that our new diagnostic rate indicator is performing as expected. If not, it's certainly not getting much worse. So we've still got some time. So move on to HIV testing. In 2008, British HIV Association set out some new guidance, and this recommended that universal testing would be put out in a variety of specific healthcare settings, including STD clinics and antenatal care. But most interestingly, we recommended a universal offer of a test to all individuals in certain areas in the population. So if you were attending hospital or you were signing up for a family practitioner for the first time, you'd be offered an HIV test. And the reason we did this is because we had worked under the assumption that if you get one diagnosis per 1,000 tests, that is cost-effective in its own right. We knew our diagnosed prevalence, and we had modeling which gave us our estimated ratio of diagnosed to undiagnosed, and we had an acknowledged lack of evidence of where it would be best to screen. We couldn't justify a universal screening program, so we needed to have some information on how best to do this. And so we've set out several pilots to determine the acceptability and feasibility of this targeted new program. And then this became policy as we started to undertake testing in these areas. So we have this data from our monitoring services to be able to show which areas in the UK have high diagnosed prevalence. So the darker colors are areas where diagnosed HIV infection is greater than 2 per 1,000. And these are the areas where local HIV providers should be offering a test to anybody who attends hospital and anybody who signs up to a general practitioner. So the ability to monitor this policy comes from two key metrics. So we can monitor our late diagnosis to see the severity of disease, and we can monitor our HIV testing in specific settings. So we have data from our STD clinics and our antenatal clinics. So we have two key systems. We have the survey of prevalent HIV infection diagnoses, which is an HIV and AIDS reporting system. And this follows patients from diagnosis through care. It's essentially a continuous cohort of all the people with HIV in England, more or less, who have been diagnosed. And we have GUMCAD, a surveillance system which records every activity in STD clinics in England. So all patient attendances and the activity and the risk factors for those individuals. We have some limits to our data. We can't record hospital and GP data as accurately on these topics. So some bespoke audits would be required for us to evaluate uptake in those areas. So from our data, we think that STD clinics and HIV care have had a material increase in testing. This is obviously on a backdrop to a widespread change in the way we view HIV testing in England. And now we don't have the lengthy consultation process pre-HIV testing, obviously, that was present in 2001. Mm-hmm. And so this has really probably been the main driver behind the wide increase in HIV testing. But we know this is the increase in testing is true, and it's been supported by the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyle data, suggesting that, which I'll show you in a second, suggesting that there has been a material increase in the type in the amount of testing for each of our interested populations. However, we still have a range in testing. So this data is fed back locally, and we know that some areas continue to have low testing activity. And so what we would expect is that almost everybody who attends an STD clinic would be offered an HIV test, but the range is about 40 to almost 100% of attendees attending an STD clinic. So this is our NatCell data showing men, women, and men who have sex with men increasing their rates of testing. So this is the reported having had an HIV test in the last 5 years from 2001 and 2011. So it's demonstrably increased testing. But whether that's related to our policy or not, I think is debatable. So this is just us pointing out some of our retention and care statistics. This is the proportion of people who are still in care 12 months after a diagnosis by various demographic and risk factors. And as you can see, we keep 90% of people in care within 12 months. And this is data that we retain from SOFID. And just to show off a little bit, this is our retention in care and the proportion who retain undetectable viral load. The 100% is estimated from modeling data, and all the rest of it is taken directly from our HIV and AIDS reporting system, suggesting that we catch about 80% of the people who we think have prevalent HIV infections. Mm-hmm. And all the way down to the end, you can see we think about 60% of those prevalent infections are currently having an undetectable viral load. Mm-hmm. So obviously our policy drive now is to expand our testing. It's that gap between the first and the second columns mm-hmm. where we're really focusing. So last one, I'll just spin through this. Waiting times in STD clinics. Waiting times, this was a real problem. There was quite a lot of evidence to suggest that STD clinics had really poor performance due to probably a lack of investment. So there were stories of mystery shoppers and data where people were being asked to wait really significant amounts of time before they could get a clinic appointment. People would contact the STD clinic and they would be seen within 28 days or less. So obviously waiting times is a key objective. And it has a range of benefits. Individually, obviously, it's better for the patient. They want to have their symptoms. Asymptomatic individuals want to be treated. At a clinic level, it could be used as a driver for improving service efficiency as the pathways through the clinic get pressed. And it has public health benefits because obviously people who are symptomatic or asymptomatic and have STDs may well continue to have sex and have transmission events. So the Department of Health aimed and set a target of 98% of people being offered an appointment within 48 hours of first contacting the STD clinic. And we initially measured this as part of the Health Protection Agency with 6 monthly clinical level audits, which we published starting in May 2004. The Department of Health gave an injection of funding to clinics to ensure that they could expand capacity where necessary. But on top of this, we had national support teams who essentially parachuted into areas that were not achieving their target and had proactive performance management to identify why a clinic wasn't succeeding and to recommend whatever it was that was necessary, for example, increasing the investment in services. So if you look at the data, it shows that obviously between February in 2006 November 2007, we changed our proportion of people seen within their offered an appointment within 48 hours of their first contact with STD clinics from just over 50% to just over 90%. So a very material change and improvement, I'm sure you'll agree. So in conclusion, we still got some time. Yeah. In conclusion, good quality data is effective at driving service improvement. Targets can increase work and they can increase investment and capacity, certainly, but perverse incentives will always exist. Not everything can be recorded, so you have to evaluate your metrics very carefully, and key metrics must be valuable for what you're trying to achieve. And then I'll talk to this to the British audience. There are some challenges for us in the future. We need to continue to evaluate sexual and reproductive care provision in primary care, so we're expanding our GUMCAD data set to GUMCAD 3. STD clinic services are now paid for out of local council budgets. This is the equivalent of an American county. Local government in Britain is local government, not local administration. They're not required by national mandate to do anything. So they have to have an open access service, but they don't have to have any particular quality or size in there. So the mechanism to enforce these national standards now lies with us almost exclusively, as we are now providing all the data for the local outcomes and process and the amount of activity in an area, which we feed back locally in order to encourage change and investment in services. So, are we in? There we go.